Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, welcome to another toy department. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. Should we just let people in behind the curtain today?
Yeah, isn't the curtain like sheer anyway?
This podcast, it is pretty sheer. The fourth wall is like the kind of wall that you get in like one of those like studio apartments that's been quote unquote reconfigured to seem like a one bedroom. You know, it's like one of those deals. Yeah.
Right.
So we are the studio that I'm in. Someone else needs to get in here at some point. So we may get interrupted at some point. There's a little bit of chaos in our facilities here the last couple weeks. So I apologize for that. So
I didn't totally realize that that was the curtain you were talking about, because we easily could edit that out.
That's also
but
true.
But now we don't have to.
That's
all
also
right.
True. But if it sounds like I'm sort of looking over my shoulder the whole show, you'll know why that is.
So you're saying this is going to be like a poor effort by you?
Yeah, possibly. Possibly.
Okay, fair enough.
It's like I'm playing hurt today.
All right. Well, I'm sick, but I'm going to really lock in.
We got a lot to run through, including a new HBO documentary, a new Netflix documentary that is all the rage. I'm sort of dying to hear what Kolsky has to say about. But I want to start with the Oscars, because that's been a tradition on the show, right? Predicting the Oscars.
Tradition.
Trying to help you win your Oscar pool. I don't know how much help we can provide this year, right? Because it seems like things are looking pretty chalky, yeah? I don't know about chalky. I'd say there's a prevailing conventional wisdom is maybe that's the better way to put it.
Well, same difference when it comes to the Oscars, right?
Yeah.
And I think often there's like a conventional wisdom of a sort, but then there's also like legitimate belief that other things could jump in and, you know, break through. And this year, there seems to be very little legitimate belief that anything could break through that is not like one of the, oh, yeah, that's probably going to win things.
Yeah. Do you read any of those like anonymous voter profiles?
I saw a little bit of the one this morning where I saw your tweet, basically.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. It's weird because usually I go to Entertainment Weekly for my anonymous Oscar takes, but that one came from The Hollywood Reporter. And it was,
by the way, at Madden on air, you know?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, yeah, at the Kolsky. This one was particularly alarming, wasn't it? In just its kind of like arbitrariness and like general ignorance of the person doing the voting and
it's only alarming if it's a surprise, right?
I guess.
Like, did you find the State of the Union address alarming?
Well, I didn't watch that.
Okay, but you get my point.
I get your point. And it's weird, like, because I want to say, like, this person's not taking it very seriously, but I don't think that's the case. I think in their head they're taking it very seriously.
Oh, no. Those are the words of someone who thinks they're taking it extremely seriously.
Yeah, but they are not. When you
No, they're just stupid.
When you go, I didn't like that there were English actresses in this role, or I want a regular movie to win, not a foreign movie, you're not
just
taking it very seriously.
Foreign.
Right?
Just wait till they see Florence Pugh playing Russian in the new Black Widow movie.
Oh, man. I'd love to see Florence Pugh in some more things, I think.
You know, I this to me is, again, it's very stupid, but it's not surprising or, like, alarming is the wrong word, because I know this is what the Oscars are, or we wouldn't have seen all the crap we've seen.
Yeah. I think, too, people need to understand, like, if representation of the Oscars is really important to you, understand that it takes a long time to flush out a lot of the people who, frankly, are older. You could sort of tell by this anonymous person that they were an older actress of some sort. It takes a long time to flush out some of these attitudes in a body that has a lot of people that are really old. And that's so,
it only takes a long time. It, you know, I...
Unless you look, if you go in and start taking votes from people, a lot of people, and adding votes to new people, you can do it fast. But that's not going to happen, right? This is not going
to
happen.
That's the point I was going to make, is this is a very easy problem to fix. It's just nobody has the stomach for it.
Yeah.
Any voting situation, almost, in our lives, political, Hall of Fame,
yeah, I was going to say, it's really not that different from the Baseball Hall of Fame, right? Like, they're taking steps, but they're not going to do the wholesale. They could, you know, fix that voting body tomorrow if they wanted.
Exactly. It's not different from any large voting body, yeah, because we as a people don't have the stomach to remove those who don't probably need to be participating at this point for whatever reason. We could do that with the American voting body. We could do it with the Hall of Fame voting body. It's easy to do. The problem is it's somewhat subjective. Like, I have strong opinions about what I believe is right in terms of who should be in there. And I think, like as an example, you could just give people like a short multiple choice test. Test some basic knowledge and basically whether they saw these films. Yeah. And I think you'd rule out half of the Academy.
Well, let me bring this a little bit closer to home, right? Because you vote in one of these awards, correct?
Yeah, the SAG Awards.
Yeah. So, but you're not an actor, right?
I'm a radio artist.
Wouldn't like, you know, if I were a person who were up for acting awards, wouldn't I be entitled to be like, well, what does this guy know? He's just in the union.
I'm pretty upset that you didn't react at all to me saying I'm a radio artist.
Oh, I think you are a radio artist.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm AFTRA, not SAG, but it's joined together. So, right. You know, that's on them.
Yeah, agreed. And that wasn't a slight at you being unqualified, but I could see how someone from 30,000 feet could view it that way, right?
But you're absolutely right, and I would not be in the slightest offended if I had to answer a series of multiple choice questions to prove I sincerely attempted to watch all the films before I was given the opportunity to vote on whether they're good or great.
There is a baseline of, like, did you watch all the films?
Yeah. I mean, that's the baseline. And then, you know, like, I also wouldn't be super offended if they gave me some questions to, like, make sure I'm not, you know, completely stupid or despicably racist. That'd be fine.
Yeah.
Like, I don't.
You know what
was
scary about that anonymous voter, right, was that some of their takes really lined up with ours, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I did not like that.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things where, like, if there's nothing controversial in the movie, then we're just judging a movie without all sorts of other things attached to it.
I mean, if you briefly made me reconsider The Irishman, then you've done something.
Yeah, I guess. I had a conversation about The Irishman yesterday, and I got even more angry.
I said briefly.
But the thing is, man, all of these problems are easily fixed. And like I always say about, you know, voting in the presidential election, like, I wouldn't be upset if this test I've proposed rules me out.
Yeah.
Well, look, because if I'm not that well informed, I shouldn't be voting.
I don't really believe in voting tests for elections.
I mean,
personally,
that's a much more complicated conversation.
You get into some weird Jim Crow stuff. But for Oscar nominations, for professional trade endeavors, yeah, sure. Speaking of which,
obviously, the politics discussion is a much more complicated one that we don't need to have. I'm just saying, anytime you have a large voting body, like, there are easy steps that could be taken to make sure the voting body is appropriately educated and prepared for the vote they're about to engage in. We just don't do that in America.
Yeah. All right, let's get to these nominations real quick, because there's a lot of them. So we'll start with makeup and hairstyling. And no, I'm kidding. Let's start with best. You were ready?
Why not?
We're going to do your whole pool for you. Let's start with best actor. Your nominees are Antonio Banderas, Leonardo DiCaprio, Adam Driver, Joaquin Phoenix, and Jonathan Pryce. And it sure doesn't seem like there's anything that's going to stop Joaquin Phoenix at this point, no?
Agreed. I have not seen two of these films. I really want to see Pain and Glory. It's just tough to find. And, you know, whatever. I'm sure The Two Popes is fine. I'll probably get to it eventually.
Pain and Glory is like Almodovar in Iñárritu?
Yes. Almodovar, I believe.
I thought it was streaming for some reason.
I don't think it is yet. I believe it's still in a limited theater run, unless that has changed recently. Yeah, I'm not sure. I've checked it in the last week or two.
Okay.
Did you say it is somewhere?
No, it's Almodovar is what I was saying, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I said. I, of the three films I have seen, would choose Joaquin Phoenix last.
Yeah, that's the way I feel.
Yeah, not because he was bad. He was very good. Very good. I just didn't think it was as interesting or exceptional a performance as DiCaprio or Driver. And I didn't even like Marriage Story that much.
I'll go a little further. I think it's an overrated performance. I think it's really tick-filled. And a little over the top.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is like, it's over the top, and I think that's appropriate, but it's also, to me, not as interesting as a subtle performance like what DiCaprio did.
Yeah. Look, I'm not saying it's a terrible performance, but I didn't think it was great. I thought it was the one of the better things in a movie that was kind of mostly a mess. And it's weird that it's going to win a lot of awards. But it is. It's going to win a lot of awards.
Yes.
Best actor in a supporting role. This is the Murderer's Row category
here. This is a heater, man. And I don't – the only one that would bother me is if Pacino won. I didn't see The Two Popes. But of the other three, to me, Joe Pesci was, even more so than Joaquin Phoenix, the one really, really excellent thing in a movie that was pretty much a mess.
I agree. I'd still give it to Brad Pitt, though.
Pitt was fantastic, but in fairness, born to play that role. And I know you didn't see A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, and I don't necessarily recommend that you do. But what Tom Hanks does on a regular basis is like magic.
Yeah.
I think he's the most consistently exceptional actor this side of Daniel Day-Lewis.
Interesting.
What's a Tom Hanks performance that like doesn't hit?
I feel like there are a few of those, to be honest. But we sort of forget them because there's so many that do.
A movie or a performance? Because there's a difference. There are Tom Hanks movies that haven't hit, right?
Yes, there certainly are.
But man, I didn't see some of the stuff, but if you just go back at over the last few years, The Post.
Yeah, I'm looking now.
Sully.
I mean, I'm going to guess you didn't see Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again.
Well, I don't think he's in that. I think he's just produced.
Okay. Wait, are you sure? I'm looking at a list of Tom Hanks performances on Wikipedia. So,
does it say producer next to that one? Because the one I'm looking at, it does.
Oh, yeah,
exact
right.
Producer right. Is what it says.
My bad.
Again, like, I don't love Saving Mr. Banks.
Yeah, but what about The Circle? Great. What's The Circle?
I don't know. That one I didn't see.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? I don't know.
Techno thriller film directed by James Ponsoldt and written by Dave Eggers.
Or A Hologram for the King. I get your point, for sure. Like, I'm not saying Tom Hanks is bad. I think he's pretty consistent. I'm just going, and when you look through these movies, there's some ones where you're like, I skipped that
one. Well, there's movies you don't care about. Like, you know what I mean? Care about
How
him
about Cloud and Atlas?
Yeah, again, that movie was questionable, but remember, he's playing like 8 roles and everyone thought he was awesome.
Yeah. All right. Fine.
That's kind of my point, is there's plenty of Tom Hanks movies I don't care about, but like, the guy just steps into roles and becomes them consistently.
Yeah. Look, I'm not on the Tom Hanks is actually Tom Hanks is bad corner. I'm not on that.
Okay. Good.
So, but I don't know that he's going to win this, right? Seems like it's Pitt or Pesci.
Right? I think it's Pesci.
I don't know, man. I kind of think it might be Pitt.
Really? All right. I have no problem with either of those, honestly. Yeah. I just kind of feel like Brad Pitt will have 10 more chances.
I guess, but he's kind of, you know, hadn't won a lot of these things, right? Is he over?
Yeah, but don't you feel like he's settling into a character actor phase?
I do. I'm just saying, you know, the Oscars loves it. It's so-and-so's time narrative.
But Joe Pesci may never act again. What better time?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I agree. They also love people in Scorsese movies. So there's that,
too. They love Scorsese. Pesci is 76 years old. His last movie before this one was in a voiceover in 2015. And before that, 2010. And before that, 2006.
Yeah.
The guy doesn't act anymore.
Pitt's only Oscar is as a producer. So
he didn't win for... Oh, yeah. Kevin Spacey won that year.
Yeah. So there you go.
How many times has he been nominated? Like three?
I don't have that in front of me.
Okay. See, the thing, I just feel like I've always been higher on Brad Pitt than almost everybody. I just think he's an awesome actor.
Yep.
But I guess he doesn't. So Moneyball, he got a Best Actor. And then Benjamin Button, a Best Actor. 12 Monkeys. And this are his only supporting. Interesting. I just think he's going to play supporting roles in potentially Oscar-winning movies for the next 20 years of his life.
Yeah, hope you're right. All right, let's jump into Best Actress. Cynthia Revo. I almost want to put an extra I in her name. Scarlett Johansson, Saoirse Ronan, Charlize Theron, and Renee Zellweger are your nominees. And conventional wisdom, and this is somewhat baffling to me, but it is conventional wisdom, is that Renee Zellweger is going to take this, right?
Yeah, and I saw Judy, but it's just really hard for me to say because I didn't see Judy, if you know what I mean.
I don't know what you mean, no. Is that a gay reference?
What?
Is that a gay reference of some kind?
No, not at all. I know nothing about Judy Garland. Especially adult Judy Garland.
Gotcha.
So, like, she did a thing that I wasn't that interested in, but she did sing it pretty well, and if that's exactly what Judy Garland was like, what the hell do I know? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean,
so I imagine, based on the reaction to it from people who love Judy Garland, that, like, to them, this was a touching tribute to a tragic decline of a great singer.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm not here giving my opinion, right? We're just predicting what's going to happen, and so I'm going to say that Judy's going to win. But Scarlett Johansson was the best of these for me pretty easily.
Really?
Yeah.
Pretty easily,
yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually. Although I have to say, both Cynthia Erivo and Scarlett Johansson I thought were excellent, too.
Yeah, well, you know, and I like Charlize Theron's performance in Bombshell, too, but I just, like I said, thought she was great in that movie. We will go to actress in a supporting role, in which Scarlett Johansson is also nominated, along with Kathy Bates, Laura Dern, Florence Pugh, and Margot Robbie. And this Laura Dern, right? Laura Dern's the front runner here?
Yeah, it seems that way, and I don't have a problem with that, although I will say there's no question Scarlett Johansson's performance is by far the best in this category.
I know how much you love that movie. For sure.
Well, and specifically her performance to me is out of this world. It's just she's so good. I mean, a theme is emerging, if it hasn't already, in 200 podcasts. Is this 200, by the way, or is this 199?
You post these things up, so you would know better than I. I think it is 199, though.
I think you're right.
Yeah. Which probably means we should really try to put something together for 200.
Oof, good luck with that. Nope, this is 200, my friend. Congratulations, we're here.
All right.
We made it. This is the last podcast.
All right, well, this is the thing we're doing for 200.
Yes. Yeah, Oscar preview is the special. It's a special 200th episode Oscar preview. We forgot to mention. As I was saying, if the theme has not emerged in 200 episodes, perhaps it is with my opinions on these categories, but I prefer a subtle performance.
As do I. As
Margot Robbie was also really good, but to me, Scarlett Johansson blows them all out of the water. I also love Scarlett Johansson unconditionally.
Well, yes. But I don't think she's going to win, right? Laura Dern's going to win.
No, I do not think she's going to win. I don't think that was another performance. Win a damn thing.
I thought was over the top. Jojo might have something in the screenplay, but then you never know. You may just get more people like, Nazis aren't funny. Good, sorry, couldn't vote for it.
So very stupid.
All right, let's do the final two, maybe together, because they're kind of a pair of awards, right? You've got obviously the big one, Best Picture. Yeah. And then Best Director. So let's do the nominees for Best Director, which are Scorsese for The Irishman, Joker, Todd Phillips, 1917, Sam Mendes, Once Upon a Time, Quentin Tarantino, and Parasite, Bong Joon-ho. Generally, you can eliminate any movie that's nominated for Best Picture that is not also nominated for Best Director. So that would eliminate Ford versus Ferrari, Jojo Rabbit, Little Women.
Yeah.
And I think that's it, right? No, Marriage Story as well.
Yeah.
So the both of these, right, are really coming down to Parasite in 1917 is the buzz out of everything, right? So Sam Mendes and Bong Joon and director, and then those two movies.
And I feel like particularly in director, like that's the price we have to pay for not having it be Scorsese or Phillips is sacrificing Tarantino. Because I think the best director of the year was Taika Waititi, but for me, Quentin should win this of the five that are here.
Yeah, that's who I would vote for. But I understand why someone would vote for Sam Mendes. And I understand why someone would vote for Bong Joon-ho, and I wouldn't be mad if either one of them won, although my vote would go to Quentin as well.
I
thought Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was the best of those movies, but I'm going to be fine if Parasite or 1917 wins, I guess. You know what I mean?
I kind of agree with that, although, like, I don't know if I could say Once Upon a Time is better than Parasite. Like, they were both excellent.
Love Parasite, yeah.
I mean, they were really both just great. But I do think, like, if we're talking about directing, what Quentin Tarantino did specifically as a director is a more complicated and elaborate and really precisely executed thing than what Bong Joon-ho did. Not because there's anything wrong with what Bong Joon-ho did, but just because of the sort of scope of the endeavor.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if we're otherwise, why separate these awards?
Yeah, I don't know. That's always a good question. Honestly, just because directors are important, they have to give directors awards is half of it.
Right.
I think that I'm going to roll with 1917 in both of these categories for my prediction.
I think so too, and it's because of the anonymous voter, right? I
mean, a little bit. I think there are going to be a lot of people that are like, I don't want a foreign film to win, which is
yeah. And then somehow
really unfortunate
leads them to 1917 being the better movie, and. We both liked 1917, I think, right? You liked it maybe even more than I did.
I did, By the way, is that not a foreign film? It's made and set in England. Sam Mendes is an English director, is he not?
Right. It's a very dumb confusion that Americans have. But here's my point. Where would you rank it out of the movies nominated? Fourth, fifth?
Somewhere in that range.
So to me, that's a bummer, but that's where we are with the Academy.
You know what? Now I kind of want to do. What is your ranking of the Best Picture nominees?
Well, I have a clear top three, and I'm not sure I can pick which I like most between Jojo Rabbit, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and Parasite. After that, I think I would go 1917. Marriage Story, Ford and Ferrari. I might put Ford and Ferrari ahead of Matt.
It's tough for me. I'm going to have Marriage Story much higher than you. That's pretty much the only.
And then The Irishman, and then The Joker, and then I didn't see Little Women.
Yeah. That's the bottom for me is. I think it might be Joker, then Irishman.
Yeah, now that I'm thinking about it, I might have liked Joker better than Irishman too.
And then big old Cliff, you know, like halfway down the Grand Canyon, hanging by a branch, Wile E. Coyote style, as Little Women.
Yeah.
Which I did not finish.
Yeah, so. Now that I'm thinking about it, definitely I like Joker better than The Irishman. And it's hard for me to actually to imagine Little Women being much worse than The Irishman.
Anonymous Voter and I were pretty much in sync on Little Women other than the Florence Pugh nonsense.
Yeah.
it is confusing and a mess. I just don't get it. I don't get the love for that movie. Much in the same way that I don't get the love for The Irishman. And that pains me to say because I love Greta Gerwig. All right, let's jump out of movies and talk about some stuff we watched last week. I want to start with McMillions.
Okay.
Because I'm just fired up about McMillions.
Oh, me too. But let me start with this, right? When we chose to watch this, right? I was like, okay, I'm in, but why do we need to have a series?
Yeah.
Like, why isn't this just a movie? How could there possibly be enough to keep me, like, week to week for however many weeks?
Well, and that
point was I wrong, man.
Yeah.
Holy moly, is this a thrill ride. This is the most exciting and, like, bouncy and fun and laughy documentary I can recall watching. The FBI agent who is sort of at the center of it.
Doug Matthews?
Oh my God, is he delightful! Yeah. I could never have imagined such a magnetic personality in a Fed. He is just perfect for, and especially for this, which, like, as serious as it is a pretty silly controversy.
Yeah, like, can you imagine if Mindhunter had an agent? You know what I mean? That was like Doug Matthews. That was just like,
oh my God,
like, guys, these stakeouts are so boring. Let's like, how can we spice this up?
It's like it's kind of McNulty-esque, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's McNulty in the early seasons of The Wire, being like, why are we sitting around on these dumb wiretaps?
Oh man. And when he goes undercover and is just like, hey, you want to take me down to the store, like, hey, yeah, let's go to the beach.
Oh my God.
So yeah,
and as he tells the story, he's like, so then I was like, let's go to the beach. Yeah. And you're just like, he is having way too much fun.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and it's one of those things that, you know, like you said, you come into it thinking six episodes, and then by the end you're like, oh my God, there's gonna be five more episodes of this. I can't wait to see where else this goes, you know.
Cannot wait.
It's such a fertile too. It's like, because everybody knows that game, right? Everybody remembers playing that game. I think very few of us knew that the whole thing was rigged the entire time. So it's like, it's such an audacious crime. And then the investigation of it, like, it's not often you find yourself, like, kind of in the shoes of the FBI and going, what a fun ride this is. You know what I mean? So
exactly.
Yeah, like, it's a really interesting position to be in. And I just, yeah, like, I was captivated the whole time. They produce it sort of with the understanding that it's fun and bouncy. Like, the music is pretty jaunty, yes, and the cuts are quick, and everybody, and like, the interview is having a great time, you know?
Yeah. And as massive criminal conspiracies go, this is pretty low stakes. So, like, you don't feel weird about giggling along.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like, you know, you're watching someone who had pulled off a real life version of, like, an Ocean's 13 caper, where, like, yeah, there's a victim, somebody got stolen from, but, like, it's a giant corporate entity with a lot of money, so it's not, you don't even really feel all that bad about that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's not like I'm sore that I never really had a chance to win $1 million off a McDonald's fry box. You
right, because I wouldn't win that anyway. Exactly. You know what I mean?
Exactly. So it really is a delightful criminal conspiracy, and the perfect FBI agent to investigate it. The whole thing, I find it wonderful. And of course, it's HBO Films, and it's a exceptionally produced documentary. Yeah.
Can't wait to see where the rest of it goes. And found myself at the drive through getting McDonald's fries last night. Don't think it's a coincidence.
I cannot support
it. It's fair. I don't go to McDonald's very often, especially now that I've, you know, kind of stopped eating meat. But
what?
Those fries are pretty good.
You're a vegetarian?
Yeah, I'm trying to stay plant-based. I wouldn't say vegetarian, because I will have meat like special occasions, but day to day life, I'm trying to stay on the plant side of things these days.
When you say plant based, are you talking? You're talking vegan?
Not talking vegan. No.
Okay.
I'd like to say plant based because it sounds better than vegetarian, but I'm meaning dairy and eggs and stuff like that. So it's not
right
vegan.
Right on. Fish?
No fish. No.
Wow! Look at you.
Yeah.
Just respecting the earth. Is that the goal, or is it a health? Is it a health measure, or a respect the earth measure?
It's more of it's a little bit about weight control and mostly just about how I feel. I actually watched a Netflix documentary that we haven't talked about. Oh my god! Now the name is escaping me.
That's produced by. I actively avoid stuff that will make me want to stop eating meat.
It's produced by James Cameron. It's called The Game Changers. That's what it's called.
Yeah, that's the last thing I need is a game change. You guys, yeah. I respect you guys for caring about the earth and animals that much, but I can't do it.
This wasn't from that approach. It wasn't about caring about animals. It wasn't about caring about the earth. It was about this might actually make you a better athlete. Not that I'm trying to be a better athlete, but I am trying to just feel better.
Be healthier, sure, yeah.
Yeah, so I was like, yeah, I'll give it a shot. And my intention was not to talk about it a lot, but I've already blown that by blasting it out on this podcast.
We can cut this out. How's okay. It going now that we're in it?
It's okay. It's going good. I mean, you know, I'm like a month in.
All right.
Doing fine. Right. I still don't eat enough vegetables, month. Though. It's too. I'm eating too many grains, but people don't need to know that. all right. McMillies is great. What else do we need to talk about? What was something that you liked this week?
There was only one thing I didn't pretty much love this week. I loved Cheer. Loved Cheer.
Yeah, let's get into Cheer.
I have watched all of Cheer.
Oh, you watched the whole thing. I'm three episodes in now.
I mean, that's half of it.
Yeah.
It is everything. And I mean that in every way. It has every element of a sports documentary that, you know, is great. It has all the right characters. It has and every single character on this show is appealing in one way or another, even the ones who are like a little bit evil or, you know, enemy sort of characters are
who in your mind are the enemies in this? Because I don't think I don't know if I could identify them.
I don't know if I'd say enemy, but enemy is too strong for anyone. But have you seen any of the other community college that they compete against that's like a few miles away?
They've talked about it's Trinity Valley, right? Is the name of it?
Yes.
They haven't spent I've met the coach there, but they haven't spent a lot of time on that through the first three episodes. They talked
okay.
about it.
They don't spend a ton of time on it, but there is a scene where he is a little bit cast as like the sports movie, like, you know, like the coach of the elite team in Mighty Ducks or something. You know what I mean?
Because he didn't really, like, I don't know. I mean, in the part that I've seen so far, they gave a lot sort of from his perspective. But he just seemed like, hey, man, I'm trying to compete against this juggernaut over here. And they have,
totally.
All the advantages.
He says some things about, like, trying to dominate the world and whatnot. And, like, yeah. Again, it's not evil is the wrong word. But just, like, the sort of a paper tiger antagonist, really. But he's just... I like him is my point.
Yeah, and if the idea of thinking it's interesting that people want to dominate the world through the sport of cheerleading is interesting to you, then you will definitely love the show.
Yeah, and I would say, like, you know, the Gabby Butler's mom is a bit of a, like,
yeah, okay,
antagonist
fair.
In some ways. Fair. You know, there are some people throughout the thing. But again...
I think you could throw her dad in that from what I can tell.
Well, yeah, they're different sort of... weird potential users. Anyway, everyone on who touches the screen is interesting in some way was the point that I was trying to make.
Yeah.
And
where are you at on Monica then? We got to, you know, Coach Monica. Where are you at on that?
I mean, she's the Greg Popovich of competitive cheerleading. And I effing love it. I mean, she is... kind of like
there's a little Coach
realize.
Taylor in her too, isn't there?
What's
little.
That?
There's a little Coach Taylor in her, isn't there?
Totally.
Yeah.
That's a great call because you realize that this has to be the most diverse in terms of like financial background competitive cheerleading team in the sport. It has to be.
Yeah.
They talk so much about how much of the sport is for basically rich white people. And this team has people of all different colors and backgrounds.
It's diverse in every possible respect, I would say.
Yeah. And like, you know, she picks people who have potential and come from broken homes and coaches them up into stars. It's how do you not love that woman?
Yeah. It was interesting to meet that dude who was like I think it was a fireman. That was like an alumni, just like
The alumni
coming back with his weird stash and like sit there and just watch practice. Like, it does. You do realize these guys are really tied into this thing that, you know.
Oh man,
you definitely
did
for a short period of time.
And I thought it made me think about how this you know like NBA truism that Greg Popovich and the Spurs come to town, and if he has a team dinner, pretty much like any Spurs alumni is expected to be there.
Yeah.
Like any Spurs alumni who are local are expected to show up at that dinner and like be feted with wine.
I was going to say, you want to show up because Pop is bringing the good wine.
This thing, it really is the golden age of documentaries.
It sure is. And this is one of those, you know what I mean? Like, and I think maybe part of that golden age is all these documentaries, like these last few years, they get that buzz. They're like, oh man, have you seen, Wild Wild Country, or, you know, have you seen Cheer? Like, they all deliver, right? Have we watched any of these where we've been like, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like,
not just deliver, but are original and interesting and fascinating stories. And at a certain level, I think all of us are always like, how do I not remember more of this? Right.
Yeah. 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 Sometimes about things that you've known a lot about. It's a great time for documentary and really historical drama, like Chernobyl style. You know what I mean?
I didn't love Chernobyl, but yes.
You didn't love Chernobyl? I don't remember that.
We talked about that.
Yeah, I love Chernobyl.
I stopped. It was too bad time TV for me.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. All right, that's fair. All right, can we talk about something I didn't love?
Yes, go ahead.
Troop Zero.
Yeah, okay. All right. Go on.
I just not my thing. I don't know. I feel like I've seen a million quirky underdog stories. And this one was not one of the better ones. It just didn't move me. I wasn't along for the journey. I didn't love the resolution. It just felt like a meh movie to me the whole time, and I felt like a waste of some of the talent therein. You know, did you feel like you were getting the best of Viola Davis or Jim Gaffigan or any of these other any of the other adults in this movie?
Maybe Jim Gaffigan, but this is not that. Did you think you were gonna get the best of Viola Davis?
I don't know. I thought it might be good. I didn't think Viola Davis was gonna phone it in.
Oh, I didn't think she phoned. See, okay. To me, this was maybe not quite as good, but in the same, like, territory as To All the Boys I Loved Before, which the only reason I choose that is because we were talking about it before the show.
Yeah, I would not put that movie in To All the Boys I Loved Before territory. Because it's not nearly as charming. Like, that movie is all charm, right?
Oh, I found this pretty charming. And I think that's where we're differing in here. At least I found the young lady incredibly charming, and the not underdogs, but yeah, it's a classic underdog story that you've seen before. Just like To All the Boys I've Loved Before is a classic romantic comedy story that you've basically seen before
and are about to see again. Apparently,
but we're both interested in watching it.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying, to me,
would you watch a Troop Zero sequel? Would you watch Troop One or whatever?
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. Because I thought it was lovable.
Okay.
I thought it was charming and lovable.
I will never think about the movie again.
Fair enough. I'm not telling you I'm going to be sitting at the Oscars going, man, if Troop Zero had come out a little earlier, it would be here. But
Next year.
But in the category of movies in a vein we've seen 1,000 times that I don't mind spending an hour and a half with. Yeah.
All right, that's fair. How many episodes of Miracle Workers did you watch?
Was there a? Oh no, did I watch two?
There are two. Yeah.
I can't remember if I watched the second one or not, which should tell you how I feel about the show.
Interesting, because and I do think it sort of matters a little bit, because the first episode was pretty piloty, I guess is the wrong word, but you know,
piloty. It was just dumb.
It was anthology episode one. You know what I mean? It was setting up a world a lot.
Boy, it was setting up a dumb world with dumb jokes, though.
All right, so clearly I'm higher on Miracle Workers than you are, in the same way that you are in Troop Zero. But look, some of that I do think is familiarity.
Maybe I need to watch this. Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like I liked that cast from season one, and I liked that they brought everybody back.
Didn't it?
It did. Yeah,
I blew it. That's 100% on me. Sorry, everybody. I meant to watch the second one, but I think I was so uncharmed by the first one. Hmm.
Yeah, like, look, I'm not going to say the first one was great television or anything.
I mean, it was 25 minutes of some of the dumbest poop jokes.
A lot of poop jokes.
I've ever heard.
Way fewer poop jokes in episode two. There may not be any poop jokes in episode two, actually. And some of those I didn't mind. You know, the whole thing with the shovel and you know, Steve Buscemi playing straight, like, you know,
don't
while being ridiculous,
wrong.
I enjoy.
I didn't mind them. I just didn't think they were especially funny or worth, like, a television show.
Yeah.
Like, there was nothing deeper than, like, a weird father-son relationship and then, like, a bunch of jokes about poop and the fact that they were in the Middle Ages.
Yeah. Well, look, I do think that there is a fair amount of comedy to be mined from just, like, how awful is life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but like... Watch the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
You know, watch Monty Python instead. I promise you'll have more fun. Like,
I'm going to at least recommend that you watch the second episode.
Okay, we can visit this next week.
Because, yeah, a lot of those things are not the case in episode two. The king, for example, I don't even think is in it. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Yeah, the focus shifts a little bit.
I've got it recording. I just didn't watch it because I sort of forgot.
Yeah, I really like this cast a lot.
I love the cast, and that's why I was disappointed.
Yeah, and I think the idea that everybody is sort of reshuffling the deck is interesting. You know,
there doesn't seem to be any relation to season one whatsoever.
There's
right?
none. It's a total anthology. It's just the same people right. in a completely different story. You know, like Daniel Radcliffe's character is quite different. From one to the next, you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
Not everybody is totally different. Obviously, Steve Buscemi's character is pretty different too. So yeah, like I don't know. I forget the name of the creator. Is it Simon Rich?
That's right.
I think he has an interesting sensibility. Some of which you can like see in like the credit shot with like the duck wandering around. You know what I mean? And like
yeah.
And I'm not gonna say the first episode was amazing. But I enjoyed it, and this is one that I'm generally watching night it comes out, if not the night after. So I feel like that's a pretty good sign for how I'm feeling about it. So
okay, I'll check in. Speaking of that, can we touch on The Outsider quickly?
Sure.
Are you watching that the night it comes out like
yeah.
I am?
Well, I feel like it moved around a little bit. Didn't it start on Monday and move to Sunday or something like that?
Maybe the other way around.
I don't totally know when to expect it half the time, and then there was like the Super Bowl threw it off or whatever. But anyway,
but like
I'm watching it when I can
to watch it.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like we got our first sort of like actual supernatural things happening this week. There still hasn't been any real horror or scare stuff.
Yeah, I don't know how much that's coming. To be honest,
I don't either, but I will say I cannot recall a show that does a better job of creating an intense, spooky mood.
Yeah. This is the kind of supernatural story that I like to watch, right? Where it's like
both of us,
there's one supernatural thing and we're real people are trying to figure it out. Like, that's a journey I can go on. You know what I mean?
Yes. It's when, like, a second person with powers shows up that you lose interest.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Then it becomes like, okay, well, what does any of this mean? This is a world where there are no rules, basically. this world, this is our world. This is our world in which something weird happens, and that I'm here for.
Yeah, and it really is just, I think it's, you know, it's the direction, it's the acting, like, there's so much here that keeps this mood so tense. And, like, you know, that's what everyone was congratulating Uncut Gems for instance.
Yeah.
And I think here's a show that creates, in a different way, you know, this is not necessarily a diss to the Safdies. It's just, this does equally as good a job of creating just as tense and intense a feeling, but it's also got a plot and a mystery at the core of it that's compelling.
Yeah, I think it's almost a more difficult job. Because, I really love what the Safdie brothers did with Mood. Like, that was a movie that I almost had to look away from. And people I watched did look away from.
But it's all Mood. It's 100%
right.
Mood.
And it just, because of that, it's just tension cranked up to 10, right? You know what I mean? You know, or 11, even. Whereas this is a subtler place of, like, disturbed reality that it needs to hold you in. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like almost a slow burn Mood. Which I think is just harder, and it's really effective at that. It really does. I really love the grafting of, like, the crime procedural onto this supernatural story. It is a really great combo. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Probably the best show on television right now. Currently, yeah.
Yeah. Probably.
I mean, I can't.
Especially after Thursday. Last Thursday.
Yeah. Oh, that's the last thing we got to talk about, huh?
That's the transition I'm setting up for you.
Well done. All right, so The Good Place wrapped up. And I don't think it's really even jumping out on a limb to say, like, I don't know that we'll ever see another show on television quite like this.
Yeah. It's an utterly singular show.
Yeah.
We've never seen anything quite like it before, and I don't know that we ever will again.
You know, it's certainly a comedy that's not only deeply interested in its characters, but in, like, philosophy.
And, like, legitimately deeply interested in moral philosophy.
Yeah.
That's what we just watched. An uproarious, tremendous comedy film or comedy series that was sincerely interested in moral philosophy.
Yeah. Someone did one of those think pieces where they're like, I'm not saying Mike Schur's shows are bad, but they don't move me. And my reaction to the piece was to just, like, feel sorry for that person. I don't. Yeah.
That's a tough break. Because they're the most. Parks and Rec, I'm not an Office guy. But specifically, Parks and Rec and The Good Place are, in my mind, two of the most deeply thoughtful and moving sitcoms we've ever had.
I am an Office guy, and I would put The Office in that category of moving. But the two shows that you mentioned are Mike Schur shows. The Office, he was certainly involved in and occasionally appeared on. But that was much more of a collab. Like, these shows, I think, and obviously he's got a lot of collaborators on both. But these shows to me are much more about his vision, I feel like. And they're truly wonders.
He was a creator on both of these.
Yeah.
And I don't know how I don't know what I honestly don't know what that person is watching.
Yeah, I mean, look, they went into it and was something I don't know. I didn't really buy their argument. They had a long argument about what it was. And I just felt bad because I just think these characters are so great. And like, the romances are so well done. And it's so much about people growing. Like, you just don't really see that on television in this way. Like, explorations of, like, people growing and having appreciation for each other. You know what I mean? As like a community.
Here's what I think is maybe the most spectacular achievement of both Parks and Rec and this show is not just people growing. People grow. Like, I think anyone who lives reasonably in the world is aware of that. But these shows create absurd characters. Absurd characters. And then given a concrete, well-illustrated absurdity, they sincerely examine personal growth from a place of absurdity.
Yeah.
And, like, it's a classic sort of, in an odd way, use of conceptually, use of hyperbole, right? Because it's these insane things being used to show us, like, what humans are capable of.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's so much great commentary on just the insanity of being human or the human experience. And there's so
Michael
many...
Schur,
yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Quickly, Michael Schur, I think, is the king of truly understanding how to show us the absurdity of humanity in all its glory.
Yeah, indeed. And like, and some of these bedded in jokes, you know what I mean? Like the way a Gardner Minshew joke is earned in this episode, you know what I mean? Over literally over 4 years of these other kind of jokes that really just started from one joke organically.
Yeah.
And there's so many things on the show that are like that, you know?
You can go back and watch The Good Place or Parks and Rec 7 times and pick up more subtle jokes. The dialogue is consistently on point. Like it's these shows are everything, honestly.
Yeah, and that makes them great for binging. And yes. Then I guess we probably should also mention too. Like, did you enjoy sort of the individual codas for these characters as they kind of, you know, step through the void at the end?
It was beautiful. I mean, I got a little teary eyed. Like. Everything. And this was a show that you could tell they understood the whole arc from the moment it started.
Yeah.
There was nothing out of place. Like, it just. It's just sad. I'm sad it's over, but I have no other complaints.
Yeah. Having, the dumbest character in the show accidentally discover like meditation, you know, stuff like that is just like, it's so, I don't know. There's nothing like this. And, I can't wait to see what the next Michael Schur show is going to be.
Yeah. I imagine there's another Michael Schur show coming and that makes me happy.
Yeah. Also, you know, he does a pretty good podcast with Joe Posnanski called The Podcast. If you ever, feel like more of Michael Schur's insights on mostly stupid things.
Follow him on Twitter at Ken Tremendous.
Yeah, and a fantastic Twitter follow as well. Even if I don't always agree with everything.
No, he came up on the radio show yesterday, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Damon did not realize who he was.
Oh.
Damon was like, there's a dude, I think he used to write for Fire Joe Morgan. He goes by Ken Tremendous.
Oh, so he got that part right, at least.
Yeah, what's funny, he knew the like sports part of Michael Schur's past, but he didn't realize he was the creator of two gigantic television shows.
Yeah, it's weird too that like his kid and like Simmons's kid are like on the same baseball team, and they're like friends with Zane Lowe's kid. There's this weird Hollywood thing that's happening now that
No, you know what it is, though? It's not a weird Hollywood thing that's happening now. It's a podcasting thing where we're finding out about all the weird Hollywood shit that's been going on for the entirety of Hollywood's existence.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, that's happening. That's happening. It is one of those things about living there, man. Those people they live there.
I was going to say, you've lived there. You know what it's like.
Yeah, sometimes you just run into them. You know what I mean?
It's one of the things about L.A. that I think people who have never been imagine to be like fantastical story about LA, like a fairy tale that like you really do just walk past stars on the street randomly, you know, like you really are just sitting in the coffee shop and like, you know, Edward Norton stops in for a latte.
Yeah, no, that stuff does happen. One of my favorite stories, my favorite, just kind of the randomness of LA stories. I had an opportunity to go to a Chris Brown party at One Oak, which I, you know, of course sidestepped because why would you? And this turned out to be an extra wise choice, more than it normally would be, because someone got shot at this party. And so it was like a big thing that was kind of, you know, like the story on TMZ. So we were sort of reading about it a little bit, and there were a lot of people who, you know, were kind of known to be at this party, including Tyrese. You know Tyrese, right?
Of course.
So we were at the Beverly Center and decided to go to Fatburger for some reason. And we walk into Fatburger, and there is Tyrese. So we start talking.
This is the same night?
This is the next day, the day after this party. So talking to Tyrese. And, wow, it sounds like things got crazy at One Oak. And, like, you get, like, the story last night. You know what I mean? And it's just like, you just run into people, man. You're in Fatburger, and so is Tyrese. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's a perfect L.A. story.
Yeah, and that's just L.A. It is what it is. You know what I mean?
And by the way, like, you know, I went to school in that area, so I know a lot of people down there, and obviously plenty of people move from here to there. But, you know, you don't have, like, anyone in the business, like, you end up sitting that, like, my friend texted me a couple weeks ago, and, you know, she's relatively connected. She writes about primarily horror films for Vulture and, you know, has press access and stuff, but she's just like, I'm sitting next to Marc Maron at a screening, you know. It's just like weird stuff like that. It's just everybody at every level of the industry, you know.
And look, in fairness, that's happened to me in San Francisco too, but it's just a lot more rare. Jake Gyllenhaal is the guy that I just run into a lot. That's just for whatever reason, like, oh, there's Jake Gyllenhaal again. Boy, that was – I did not – that sounded like a humble brag, and I really didn't mean it that way.
No, that's what's funny about L.A. There's nothing braggy about it. You literally just bump into people.
Yeah, it's just what happens. All right, should we do some homework?
Yes, sir. Wait a second, though. I need to pause. I'm getting a call from my boss, and I think the Warriors just made a huge deal. Hold on.
Yeah, apparently I'm getting Andrew Wiggins is what I'm hearing is involved in that in some way. All right, so you're back.
And, oh, my goodness.
And we had a blockbuster trade between the teams in Minnesota and San Francisco, so I feel like we may need to talk about this.
First of all, I love that we somehow, like, can represent the two towns in this trade.
Yeah.
So let's just...
Hey, hold on one second.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm back. So, it's amazing that our two towns made a trade. And we're here to talk about it. You've had 2 minutes to analyze it. What's your take for the Warriors here? I guess we should tell people what the deal is, since it just happened.
Yes. I just clicked off Woj right before.
I got you. All right, said that. So the Timberwolves get from the Warriors D'Angelo Russell. Obviously, that was the big prize for them in this, along with Jacob Evans and Amari Spellman.
Yep.
And then going back to Golden State, Andrew Wiggins, a 2021 protected first round pick. It's protected up to number 3 and then unprotected after that. And then a 2022 second round pick. So Wiggins, a first in 21 and a second in 22.
Right. So let's start with this. I don't expect that protection to come into play, because As rough as their things have been for the T-Wolves, I would expect them to be out of the worst three teams in the league.
Next year?
Now that's... Go ahead.
Next year you expect that? Because I would say give you the old Corso not so fast.
Really?
On that. Yeah.
Okay.
Look, the Timberwolves are obviously they're bad at pretty much everything right now. But defense in particular, and you're going to go into that with two of your five guys in Cat and Russell being minus-minus defensive players, and your best defender walked out the door in a trade the other day. So, mm-hmm. This is not a fully formed team. Like, the Timberwolves are now in a better position than they were yesterday and the day before, but there's nothing that says to me they won't necessarily be quite bad next year.
They may be, but they're going to get their draft pick this year, which is likely to be pretty high.
Yes.
And, like...
Top five, probably. But it's a bad draft, also.
Well, okay. But it might be a bad draft for superstars. I don't know that it's a bad draft for a guy who can help you. But, also, when you talk about Karl-Anthony Towns as a minus-minus defender, I think you have to ask how much of that is about a 24-year-old kid who's been in a pretty rough situation overall, who is the most miserable-looking player on the floor in the entire league.
Yeah.
Well, certainly non-Kyrie division.
Well, he hasn't won a game since December, and they lost by they got thumped at home by the Hawks last night. So,
I get it. It's rough. And yet, he is one of the most talented players in the league and has had moments where he has played MVP-level basketball. And
I'm not saying he's bad. I'm just saying he's bad at defense. And he's consistently been bad at defense, whether he's had good or bad players around him.
Not in college.
Okay, sorry. In the NBA.
But part of his appeal in college was he was a defensive stud.
Yeah, everyone thought he was going to be a lockdown defender when he came into the league. It just hasn't worked out that way.
Yeah, so all I'm saying is I don't think it's impossible to get league average defense out of him. And he's a big body, if nothing else. D'Angelo Russell is going to be always a bit of a liability on the defensive end, just physically, but that doesn't mean you can't build a team that defends fine if he is giving a sincere effort. It just depends what you put around him. I'm just saying, for a team that has been terrible, they'll have two pretty good established young pieces who really seem to love each other at the start of next year. And if they do a half decent job of building around them, and they have hired a competent general manager as well. And if they do a decent job of building around those guys, I think they can get out of the bottom three. I'm not saying they're a playoff team.
I think they can get out of the bottom three too. I just don't know that it's going to happen in 2021 when this pick comes due.
But then if that's like, listen, I think you're getting a top 10 pick next year or a top 15 pick in 2022, which are both expected to be better drafts than the one this year, right?
One of these drafts is going to be the super draft, right? With the high school and college classes in it. Correct? 21 or 22, isn't it?
So, that's a theory. I don't know if that's the case.
Yeah.
You know, we won't know till we know.
But I think NBA teams are operating under that assumption, I feel like. So
that's right.
So, and we know this draft isn't going to be great, and the Warriors will have a high pick in it. And then now they've got an opportunity to have a high pick in 2021
in the following draft as well. That's correct.
Where does Wiggins fit into that team to you, though? That's the question that I want to ask.
He positionally and theoretically, he fits in great. Now there's the question of
the word theoretically is doing a lot of work in that sentence, I feel like.
Well, it's the same theory I just described with Karl Anthony Towns. The difference being the situation that Wiggins is going to, we know to be stable and we know to be capable of helping guys fulfill some of their promise. Because we've seen it repeatedly with players of various skill levels, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the Warriors have taken guys, and sometimes they've taken guys who you don't, sometimes they have taken guys who it only gets you so far, and sometimes they've taken guys who they haven't been able to develop, but pretty consistently, they found guys in the second round of the draft, on the scrap pile after a five-year career, etc. The Mo Spates, the Barbosas, the Draymond Greens, the Festus Ezeles, the Kevon Looney even. First rounder, but end of the first round. And they have turned these guys into more than other teams might have. Andrew Wiggins, at 24 years old, has had, I believe, four coaches in 5 years. One of his coaches, reportedly the one he most identified with, literally passed away during that time. And he's as physically talented as any wing, specifically, you know, small forward in the entire league. And small forward is a position of weakness before this for the Warriors. He's also a guy who's capable of, sometimes does it too much, but is capable of getting his own shot and scoring at a pretty high level. He has also increased his assist total by more than one assist this year, which is substantial for a guy like him. So I don't see a 24-year-old Andrew Wiggins as irredeemable. And I think the Warriors are the best possible situation to try to redeem some of the parts of his game that have held him back to this point, most specifically defense and like court awareness.
Okay. I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying.
Quickly.
All right. I just want to say that I feel like I'm in somewhat a unique position here as a Warriors fan. So I certainly believe in the organizational strengths that you're talking about. In addition to being a Warriors fan, I am a Wolves watcher. You know what I mean? I probably see as much of the Wolves as I see as any team in the NBA, including the Warriors. And I get what you're saying, and there's certainly a case to be made that they could fix this guy. I do not believe it will happen. I just don't.
Well, here's the other question you have to ask yourself is, what does a fixed Andrew Wiggins look like on this Warriors team? What does that mean? Because to me, like, right now the guy's shooting 19 shots a game. To me, you cut that to 15. They're all wide open. And ideally, you get better defense and a couple extra rebounds. Like, that to me is fixing Andrew Wiggins.
Yeah, look, if he's taking the right shots, if he's available on defense, and if he's locked in, pun intended, for 40 minutes a night, then great. Then you might get that. But just the history of him and having watched him a lot, like, he is a guy that he can go for 30 any night still. He is a guy that you forget is on the court for long, long stretches. And I just don't know how that's going to play. And when you throw in the fact that he makes $27 million this year, $29 million next year, $31 million the year after that, and $33 million in 2022-23, yikes. Yikes, yikes, yikes. So,
But that doesn't matter. Here, let me explain to you why that doesn't matter. That only matters in the context of whatever else they would have been able to get for D'Angelo Russell. So the way this becomes a bad trade is if we go into the summer or the summer, and all of a sudden Joel Embiid and Bradley Beal are readily available.
Not impossible. At least one of those, anyway.
Well, yeah, but readily is the key word there.
Yeah.
Because if they're not available for D'Angelo Russell, then you wouldn't have been able to get them. And the other thing I think this trade tells you is that the Warriors have they have a belief that they can fix Andrew Wiggins, whatever that means.
Obviously.
And second of all, I believe they have a priority, and whose priority this is a fascinating question. My guess is it's Bob Myers' priority, and some other people might not be thrilled about it. But they clearly have a priority to avoid what a lot of dynastic basketball teams go through, which is utter collapse at the end of the dynasty. Because this trade seems to have been nearly as much about future draft assets as about anything else.
I hope so, because I think the team is worse in 2021 right now than it was yesterday. Yeah, I do.
I think if they'd have just kept Wiggins than with Russell.
Yeah.
Oh wow, I strongly disagree with that.
Yeah. In fact, I don't think it's that close.
I think you are underestimating two things. One is how bad the defense would be anytime you have Steph, D'Lo, and Clay on the floor at the same time.
Yeah, it's going to be the same. Wiggins is not a good defender. I know he looks like he should be a good defender. He's not.
It doesn't matter. Simply by being 6'8", your team defense is going to be significantly better.
That only works if you stay near people.
You can say that, and that's fine, but ignoring the possibility that he would stand near people more often, which I still believe.
Okay. Like, I believe it's a possibility, not ruling out its possibility.
D'Angelo Russell's effort on defense was not that bad. And he's awful.
Yeah.
Like,
wait till you see awful and also not trying.
Okay. We'll see. We'll see about that. But I'm telling you, it can't be a bigger problem than the size and like defensive ability matchups you'd have with Russell in there with those guys.
Yeah,
I agree.
I agree with that. You're limiting some of the matchup problems, and you got yourself. Look, your pick situation is better.
That's right. Yeah. And that's the point I'm making is I think if they wanted to go into the offseason and package their pick with D'Angelo Russell, like if that was something they were entertaining seriously, they would not have made this deal. This deal tells me they want to use that pick to take a player who can be a part of their future, however good people say this draft is or not.
Yeah, I know. The pick's in the next draft, right?
I'm talking about the Warriors' own pick this year.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the way I think you could paint the picture in your mind of I have the ability to get better players and better packages in the offseason with D'Angelo Russell is if you imagined putting either your draft pick or potentially Draymond into trade packages,
yeah.
Right? This trade, the fact that they pulled the trigger on this trade today tells me that they were not interested in putting that pick or Draymond into trade packages this summer. Because I imagine if they were, they'd have waited to see what was out there.
Yeah. I mean, maybe.
And I think that also tells you, like, if you want to win as soon as possible, you don't trade Draymond Green, period. Right. So I think this tells you they both want to win as soon as possible, and they want to kind of ensure that they have some pieces set up for the future. And I think this serves both of those masters.
Yeah, look, I like that they got a pick, and maybe that's what it's about for them. But, I think the Wolves got the better of this trade. I think the Wolves are delighted to get off of Andrew Wiggins and blow this up in some way. You know, look, they knew that the Wiggins-Towns core thing just wasn't going to happen. So
no, but I think this is...
And this is a chance to reset.
Yeah, but I think what you just said applies to the Warriors, too. As weird as it sounds, 3 months into the D'Angelo Russell experiment when we never even got to really run it.
Right.
I think... And I never got to say the second thing I thought you were underestimating. The first being the like size and defense deficiency with Russell. The second is, and this one is actually not for me that directly a criticism of him. It's just a bummer. He and Steve Kerr just see their philosophy on the game of basketball is just different. And I don't think it could ever have worked.
Yeah, well.
And it's not even necessarily
a philosophical.
You're
also making the case against Andrew Wiggins, I'm telling you. I mean, look, I hope I'm wrong. I hope he sees the lighting and that the incredible staff they have there in Golden State is a difference maker for him. But, man, I would not make that bet.
Hold on a second. Because it's not a philosophical choice for D'Angelo. It's just a matter of what he's good at.
Yeah.
And he's great as a pick and roll guard. He's great as a quickly get your own shot to bail you out. He truly does have ice in his veins. He's a cold-blooded scorer. But he does not fit that well into the way Steve Kerr thinks basketball should be played. You taking the ball out of his hands, you know, focusing on ball and man movement, that reduces the effectiveness of D'Angelo Russell. And I just don't think there was ever going to be a way that he'd have the ability to like come into his best self under Steve Kerr. And I think Wiggins is different in that respect. It doesn't make it any more or less likely that Wiggins will actualize that potential, but his potential could fit.
Yep. All right, well, I'm excited to revisit this with you in a year's time.
That's when the rubber will meet the road, is a year from today, basically.
Then we'll start to know. But I will be very surprised if you guys are if you are not saying as a Warriors fan at that point, God, man, we probably could have gotten more out of that deal. That's where I think you'll be at. Or we should have waited till the summer.
Yeah, I mean,
or whatever.
Part of the issue here may be that I'm not necessarily a Warrior fan per se, so much as someone who covers the team.
Yeah, we is probably the wrong word. But you know what I mean? The Warriors.
No, but I say that to say, like, the intrigue of the experiment here is appealing to me.
Yeah. I don't know. Fight with the Warriors, honestly, I really would have like, tried my best to get Covington out of there. Obviously, he wound up getting traded.
He was gone.
Right. By the time this deal was consummated, but not during the period that they were talking, obviously. So.
Yeah, but there was no really good way to have Covington be the centerpiece of this deal from a contract.
Right, the money didn't work, yeah. So.
Yeah. And again, like, this is a gamble. No one's going to tell you otherwise, but it's a gamble with a big payoff if they can make it work. And not just a big, you know, payoff in the player Andrew Wiggins, but a big payoff in like the cachet of the culture of the franchise.
Do you, I know we got to go, but I'm just going to ask this one question. Like, do you not think it's rare that a player figures it out at 25 in his, what, sixth or seventh season in the league?
I don't think it happens every day, but it does happen. And I think it's not so much more rare than just the existence of players like Andrew Wiggins in the first place.
Yeah. Okay.
I'd say given an Andrew Wiggins type, it's maybe 50-50, a 50-50 proposition if he gets to a good place that he might figure it out.
All right. I really have to go. And I think you'd probably do too, because you got to go talk about
this
right on the radio.
I sure do. I
got
to go get to work right now. And in fact, if this podcast doesn't arrive until Thursday evening, everyone should know why.
Here's the homework real quick. We talked about Mike Shore, one of his shows, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, returns this week, so we're going to revisit that. Briar Patch, which is the Annie Greenwald show we've been talking about a little bit. There's a To All the Boys I've Loved Before sequel on Netflix that comes out on Wednesday. And we're going to try, we're not promising, but we're going to try to go see the Harley Quinn movie.
I can promise it. I just bought my tickets.
Okay. Kolsky can promise. I cannot.
Okay.
Say bye.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.